This is Bill Munhausen with another episode of What Makes Sense, a podcast and blog that addresses solutions, blending Christian thought with a pragmatic foundation, leading to a unity of understanding. That's a mouthful, kind of philosophical, but I'm trying to convey a quest for truth and a reformation of the American spirit. Christians often say that we walk by faith and not by sight, and of course it's true, but it also leads some people to distrust, I guess, thinking about things, and that's where the pragmatic comes into play. Christianity is a very evidence-based faith. If you think back to the Gospels where Jesus is being confronted by Thomas, remember doubting Thomas? And Thomas is wondering whether the resurrected Jesus really is Jesus. And Jesus doesn't say, just have faith. Of course it's me. Instead, the Lord says, here, look at the wounds on my hands and feet. Obviously it's me. You can touch me. You can see the evidence for yourself. He was calling on Thomas to be pragmatic more than faithful. And so we have to always think about the created world as part of the evidence for the God who created all things. So with that in mind, I have a little bit of a rant today. The rant is against the fragmentation that is overtaking the American people. There came a point, and I don't remember when it occurred, that a significant number of conservatives determined that mainstream social media platforms were no longer free and uncensored. I'm sure that I was one of those people recommending that you abandon Facebook and Google because participating in those platforms helped to fund and support their stranglehold on the public square. What I didn't anticipate is that people would simply switch corporate platforms, as if another corporate platform is the perfect solution. A lot of this happened when Twitter and Facebook acted in unison to ban the President of the United States. I mean, how do you censor the leader of your country, no matter how partisan you are? It was unconscionable, somehow bizarre. But somehow, conservatives didn't rebel against that idea. Instead, they accepted that private corporations have freedoms, including the freedom to violate the United States Constitution, the freedom to violate free speech, the freedom to censor people, even the President of the United States. This is why I distrust ideology so much. Because according to conservative ideology, you have to respect the rights of corporations, and you also have to try to champion the rights of individuals. And there is an inevitable conflict in it. You have to take somebody's side. And for me, I always take the side of the underdog, the individual. Corporations have gazillions of dollars they can take care of themselves. Sometimes corporations have to be limited because of the tremendous influence they have, because of the power they possess. Google, for example, controls a great percentage of all the information distributed around the world. By definition, they are subject to what we used to call the antitrust laws. They have too much power, and we have to restrict their ability to restrict others. So, I don't really buy into that whole conservative libertarian idea that we have to respect the freedoms of giant corporations. They have no freedoms. People have freedoms. Now, getting back to the fragmentation issue, many Christians fled to social media platforms, and they have names like Rumble and Parler and Signal and Getter and MeWe and Truth Social, Gab, WeGo, Frank Speech, and Telegram. Crazy names. They did so, the Christians leaving these the main platforms, because they wanted access to uncensored information, or they wanted a safe place to share information without as much fear of government tracking their activities. It was a retreat driven by principle and paranoia, but it has had one great unintended consequence. It fragmented conservative activists and isolated conservatives from the fellow citizens they need to influence. I have a friend who doesn't like YouTube. He doesn't trust YouTube. He thinks YouTube censors people too much. So he always goes to Rumble. He advocates for Rumble. And Rumble is okay, but the problem with Rumble is it's widely known as a largely conservative place. So if you go to Rumble, you hear other people telling you information from your own perspective, and it isolates you. You can't reach people that you need to reach outside of the conservative community. You are happy listening to people who think like you do, but I think it's important that you be out on the main platforms engaging with people who don't agree with you. So that's the downside of all of these kind of fringe social media platforms. You have to be in the public square, not in a closet somewhere. Now, conservatives thought they were hurting the mainstream social platforms, but I suspect they were merely playing into their hands. Instead of having to censor conservatives and marginalize them through algorithms, sites like Facebook and Twitter alienated conservatives so that they would self-isolate. They kind of drove the conservatives out of those mainstream platforms. The brilliant strategy to make conservatives irrelevant was to trick them into abandoning the public forum and running off to a self-imposed social media ghetto. Much like the Jews in Nazi Germany, conservatives feel safe in their ghettos. But history tells us there is no safe place from the ruling secular authority. Decades ago, our Christian churches drifted into a similar self-isolation. The New Testament refers to Christians as the Ecclesia, meaning a called-out assembly. What's interesting about the term Ecclesia is its double meaning. It was a term used by the Greeks to describe civic governing bodies who were called out from the mass of citizens to a role of public services. They were representatives of the citizens, and it was just about secular government. When that term was applied to followers of Jesus, it carried the extra meaning of being called out to separate from the world system. So many Christians take it as not being involved in worldly matters. You can see how the two meanings conflict. In one sense, it was about secular or civic government. In another sense, it was about being separated from worldly matters, which is what the secular civic government does. And it led many people to just stay away from politics, in spite of Jesus' command to make disciples of the peoples of every nation. Nations are inevitably political, even though they are grounded in similar people joining together to form a nation, they eventually become a political institution. Unfortunately, church people embraced isolation and allowed the culture around them to disintegrate. Again, they became fragmented from the mainstream. It was like they ran off to their own non-digital social media platform. They joined together, they had community, it was terrific. But meanwhile, the rest of the world was going down the tubes. And certainly that's what we see in today's world. As I've watched this fragmentation unfold, I've purposed myself to embrace the mainstream by keeping a regular presence on Facebook and YouTube. Many locals don't know it, but we face a struggle in maintaining our community's identity. The best way to preserve the freedom we have at Lake of the Ozarks is to be spokespeople for truth on the biggest and most influential platforms we can find. We may not approve of Google or Facebook, but we can use the power of their platforms to make our case to the American people, to our fellow citizens, to our friends and neighbors. And keep this important reality in mind. We may operate under the label of conservative, because that's the title the world recognizes. But we are really reformers and revolutionaries. America has always been the land of innovation, and that applies to public life. There is little left to conserve. That's why I say we're not really conservatives. But there's a lot of territory to take back from the enemy. I'm not talking about returning to the 1950s, as some liberals would say we are trying to do. We're actually trying to perfect the American system. We're neither abandoning it nor returning to the past. We are the true progressives, not the progressives in name only. I read an interesting book a few years ago called The Tipping Point. Its premise was simply having a good idea is not enough. The idea has to be translated into terms that people can understand. It has to be advocated by a small but loyal team of people, and then it must be communicated consistently until it reaches a tipping point of acceptance by the broader population. If conservative Christian reformer revolutionaries want to win over the hearts of fellow Americans, we must operate in unity, even if it seems to go against principles. This is the core idea of Key Radio, to develop a central clearinghouse for constructive ideas and solutions that everyone at Lake of the Ozarks will come to embrace. Maybe you are someone who can catch that vision and help us bring area residents to the tipping point before it's too late. The problem with the tipping point idea for conservatives is that conservatives are notorious for dividing over funny little nuances in ideology. And that's a problem that the left hasn't had. The liberal left, whatever you want to call them. I remember way back when my kids were little, I was actually teaching about creation versus evolution, that whole controversy. And I was noticing that in a lot of popular culture, evolutionary concepts were being presented that really had nothing to do with what else was being presented. Let me give you an example. That's kind of a confusing way of saying it. I remember a little children's cartoon called The Land Before Time. And it was about a little group of talking dinosaurs. They were little talking dinosaur characters. And they were juvenile dinosaurs, so they could relate to kids. And the dinosaurs went through lots of adventures. I think, as I remember it, they accidentally adopted an egg, and the egg hatched into a baby T-Rex. And since they were all non-meat-eating dinosaurs, the T-Rex had an issue because the T-Rex kind of, by instinct, wanted to eat them. But anyhow, that's the gist of the plot of the story. But at the very beginning of this cute little kid's cartoon was a two or three minute overview of evolution. Started with the primordial soup in the ocean, and something in the soup suddenly became alive, and the alive thing developed into a multicellular animal, and then the multicellular animal became fish, and then the fish became amphibians, and before you know it, you had dinosaurs. And I think even people were in there somewhere. That whole little two-minute segment had nothing to do with the plot of the cartoon. It was just thrown in there to plant a seed. Not to plant a seed in the minds of adults, but to plant a seed in the minds of children. And I could see that over and over through popular literature, through storytelling, through movies, through children's books and children's cartoons. This kind of pandering to an evolutionary idea to plant seeds about how true evolution was, even though the evolution theory has been falsified over and over many different times. So that was my first experience with the idea of a tipping point. By constantly showing these little evolutionary evidences or proposals, over time, people came to accept evolution as something to be true. It was more effective than teaching it in the classroom because it became part of popular culture. Another example of how that's done is in global warming. Almost every natural history documentary or article that you read has something to do with climate change. We have a hurricane coming. This is in the weather report. There's a hurricane coming off the coast of Florida, and hurricanes are much worse because of climate change. It's one of those things that is impossible to prove because we don't have records of hundreds of years ago about how severe hurricanes were. We have pretty good evidence that they were just as severe as today, but by planting the seed that storms are worse today because of climate change, people come to believe that climate change is a real thing. This has nothing to do with whether you believe in climate change or not. I'm just saying that the left, the people who advocate for these kinds of things, are very consistent and unified. They all present the same story once they have a story to present, and they don't deviate it. They don't worry about which leftist group has differences in ideology with another leftist group. They just are united in pervasively, consistently relating a story, in that case about climate change. Nowadays, we have consistent storytelling about the LGBTQ movement. Almost every TV show you watch has a gay or lesbian character. Even Star Trek. And Star Trek is supposed to be a vision of the future, and I guess the modern producers of Star Trek episodes have decided that it's got to be an LGBTQ future. Because from the left's perspective, they don't consider the morality or anything about the value of LGBTQ. They just see them as a voting bloc. They want to have the votes of LGBTQ people. They don't want conservative Republicans to have those votes. So once again, they are very consistent. They all jump on the same bandwagon. Somehow, we need to get conservatives, you know, us revolutionary reformation type people, to join together, to put aside our petty differences and look at the big picture and try to create that same tipping point that leftist philosophers have so consistently and effectively produced. So, tipping point, keep that in mind. There is a big picture in how to be unified, and I've been working on the bigger picture for a long time now. It's the Article 5 movement. The Article 5 movement comes from is named after Article 5 of the United States Constitution. It's sometimes referred to as the Convention of States, or COS as a shorthand label. And the idea of Article 5 is to rein in the power of the federal government by all of the states getting together and devising one or more amendments to the Constitution to limit what the federal government can do. And once again, it's one of those things that conservatives argue over. Some people say if we ever had a convention like that, crazy people would try to rewrite the Constitution completely. Of course, that isn't part of the Article 5 of the Constitution. Article 5 of the Constitution only allows amendments. It doesn't allow rewrites. But they say, look what happened back in the 1700s when the colonies got together to change the Confederation. And they ended up writing a new constitution, which is, of course, the constitution we have now, a constitution that has lasted for quite a long time, but now is at a point where people in Washington, D.C. basically work around it. They claim to support the constitution. They swear an oath to defend and uphold the constitution, but then they reinterpret what the constitution says and do what they want to do anyway. And we all know about it in the conservative movement. We are all frustrated about it. Convention of States gives us an opportunity to rein all of that in. So let me explain. What I want to say about Convention of States is that the rap against it is that it could result in a runaway convention where lots of changes happen, because the basic feeling of modern conservatives is that modern people aren't smart enough to meaningfully craft an amendment to the Constitution to limit the federal government. If we have a convention, something terrible will go wrong. However, recently the COS Foundation performed a test run of an Article 5 convention. You might call it a proof of concept effort to determine whether delegates from around the country could evaluate some of the paths that might yet restore our nation to its historical greatness, rooted in our historical goodness and sense of fair play. Would a COS convention ruin the Constitution, or would it create some constructive proposals to restore its authority? The good news is that this test run of COS worked wonderfully, and they produced a number of proposals. Now understand, all of these proposals wouldn't be adopted in a real convention, but they wanted to test out what kinds of ideas would come out of a convention. So I'm going to go and I'm going to review these things one at a time, maybe comment about them a little bit. So here we go. Proposal 1 was about federal term limits. Section 1 says that, quote, no person shall be elected to serve in the House of Representatives more than 9 full terms, that's 18 years, nor elected or appointed to serve in the Senate more than 3 full terms, also 18 years. This article shall not disqualify any person from completing a term in the Congress to which that person was elected or appointed prior to ratification of this article. Section 2 states that no person shall serve in Congress, both houses, for more than 24 years in total. The intent of this proposal is that we have to stop people from staying in government forever. Basically, we have some people who get elected to Congress, either house, and end up serving there for 40 or 50 years. And they become entrenched. They end up having too much personal power, or they end up just being an obstruction to real progress. So we need to prevent that. We need to make sure that citizens are circulated through Congress, that they all serve for a period of time, and they don't stay on too long. I believe the 18-year limitation in this proposal is pretty good. That sure seems like a long period of time, but you have to give people a chance to learn the ropes, so to speak, and get on the right committees and serve effectively before they're forced out. So 18 years is plenty of time, maybe a little long, but maybe just right. Proposal number 2, placed limits on the jurisdiction of the courts. Section 1 states, the Supreme Court of the United States shall consist of 9 judges, any 6 of whom shall constitute a quorum. Section 2 says, each of the several states shall have standing to bring an action challenging the constitutionality of any action of the executive branch or any enactment of Congress. So the idea of this is, again, we don't want a Supreme Court that gets packed. We're going to specify, which the original Constitution did not, the number of judges, and we're going to make sure that at least 6 of them are there in order to make a decision. We're also going to make it easier for individual states to bring something before the court to challenge the constitutionality of it. The mechanism for bringing something to the Supreme Court to challenge its constitutionality right now is very long and convoluted. This proposal allows a state government, to bring anything to determine its constitutionality. It returns a certain amount of power back to the states. The convention, or the test convention, also proposed these fiscal restraints. Proposal 1 was divided into several sections. Section 1 states, Congress shall adopt a preliminary fiscal year budget no later than the first Monday in May for the following fiscal year and submit said budget to the President for consideration. No more of this stuff where we just run through the year without a budget in place. Federal expenditures for each fiscal year shall not exceed average annual revenue collected in the prior 3 fiscal years. Total expenditures shall include all expenditures of the United States, including those for payment of interest on debt. Total revenue shall include all revenue of the United States, except that derived from borrowing. In other words, we can no longer balance the budget or exceed the budget just by borrowing money from the Federal Reserve. Any surplus of revenue over expenditures in any fiscal year shall be applied to outstanding federal debt. Section 2 says, Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses of Congress by roll call vote deem it necessary, may exceed the spending limit in Section 1 for one fiscal year by borrowing as provided for in the second clause of the 8th section of Article 1 of this Constitution. Section continues, taxes levied under the 8th section of Article 1 of this Constitution shall not be raised to increase the revenue of the United States unless two-thirds of both houses of Congress by roll call vote concur. Section 4 says nothing in this amendment shall be construed to allow for an increase in taxes without the express approval of Congress. And Section 5, this amendment will become effective 3 years after ratification. The intent of all this verbiage is to force the federal government to have a balanced budget, to no longer just continue to increase debt so that they can spend money on whatever they like. Rather than be concerned about the specific kind of overreach of the federal government and trying to legislate each thing that they can and cannot do, this amendment would simply limit how much revenue they receive and therefore how much revenue they can spend. The intent is to, I guess you could say, starve the federal government so that they can't do things beyond their usual authority. The last one I'll mention closes an important loophole in the Constitution. It has to do with interstate commerce. The Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution has been used to justify all kinds of regulation for any kind of activity that crosses state lines. So, for example, a river crosses state lines, so you can regulate the river. But more than that, if one state is sharing water supply with another state, that kind of sharing can be regulated also. And the definition of a waterway can be any kind of waterway, even if it isn't something that boats can travel on or commerce can take effect on. Any kind of stream or lake or any kind of even a man-made waterway could be considered something that the federal government can regulate. So here's what they say. A proposal to close a constitutional loophole, thereby limiting federal jurisdiction. Proposal 1, Section 1 says, commerce among the states shall mean buying, selling, or transportation of commercial goods and services across state lines. Section 2 continues, Congress shall not delegate any rule-making function related to commerce among the states to any executive official or agency. That's very important. You can't just have agencies making up rules. Congress should make the law. Section 3 states any federal law or regulation existing at the time of ratification of this amendment in conflict with this amendment shall become null and void 2 years after the date of ratification of this amendment. Anything that's been put in effect in the past that conflicts with the new rules becomes ineffective after 2 years, and that gives regulators a chance to look for a legitimate way to meet whatever ends they intend. Section 4 says, for purposes of this Constitution, navigable waters shall be limited to surface waters actively used for transport of goods in commerce among the states. Navigable waters would not include water underground flowing between states, which is something that currently gets regulated. All kinds of things get regulated that shouldn't be, because they really don't represent interstate commerce, but the Interstate Commerce Clause has been used to make them capable of being regulated, you might say. I'm running out of time for this episode, so let me tie things together. I began by explaining the fragmentation of conservative activists and how, in contrast, members of the political left work in concert with one another. In that respect, we must be more like them. The Article 5 Convention of States movement promises to limit the left by reducing the financial resources of the federal government, thereby reducing their power. Conservative reformers must put aside their differences and unite around their common goals. Convention of States has been tested and proven, and may be that unifying movement we need to perfect American government. If not this idea, then look for other ways to support your fellow conservatives. Bring America to a constructive tipping point.